Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
John Quiggin.
And John, it's great to have you here. And I like both what looks like a colourful, almost Spider-Man t-shirt, it looks like you're wearing, and you have a bucolic vision behind you in your artificial backdrop, I guess, which looks like a very eminent institution. Now, I assume it's not a prison.
No, it's the University of Queensland, which has at least appointed there, although physically I'm quite a ways from there. A lovely campus, built at precisely the right time, out far out enough to have a big campus, but we have some nice sandstone buildings. And the T-shirt is raising money for Fred Hollows, who's the institution who devoted to curing blindness. So I run one of my activities is my main activity really other than work is triathlon. And so I do running and cycling and raise funds for various charities.
Oh, how fantastic. That's great. So thanks for the textual analysis of your body and your backdrop.
Yes.
And where are you actually today, John, may I ask?
I'm in a town called Mareeba in far north Queensland. My wife has a little farm in this general area, and so we spend quite a bit of time up here.
Fantastic. Okay, so first question, apart from all these personal and invasive ones, is to ask you what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you?
Well, I guess I'm mostly preoccupied with things happening in the US, largely Trump and what I see as the impending threat of dictatorship, and then the recent events with protests and their suppression, and also the apparent inevitability of a rerun of the pandemic, messing it up even worse this time than we did last time.
All good points. It is extraordinary to see the Supreme Court being in the pocket of a would-be dictator, and yet not surprising given that so many of them were appointed by him and his oleaginous kind. And, of course, as is the case with many such dictators, there is a groundswell of support among some sectors of the population, people who really have been left behind in many cases.
I must say I don't really buy this analysis. If you look at Trump's 2016 vote, the vast majority of the people who voted for him voted for Mitt Romney 4 years earlier. And Mitt Romney, on that analysis, ought to be somebody that we hate. And of course, they do hate him since he was one of the few Republicans to stand up against Trump. But he's the arch globalist, Bain and Company, and so forth. So if it's left behind, it's not in any simple sense. It's people who don't like the way the US is going, see their status as declining somewhat relative to other people, but that can be people who are very much at the top of the tree themselves, just seeing the wrong sorts of people coming to join them.
Oh, I agree with that. I was talking about the margins. The fact is, if my cat Chinguri, whom you can see here, were nominated by the Republican Party for the presidency, unlikely because he wasn't born there nor born before the Constitution,
indeed,
40% of US citizens would vote for him, because they vote for the Republican Party. And it doesn't matter who the Republican Party's candidate is. So there's no doubt about that. It's the 10% of people who are at the margin of where their vote will go that I'm referring to. And many of them are people who feel as though they've been left behind, rightly or wrongly.
I guess it's, for me, it's always the dog who didn't bark. That is, what happened to the decent suburban Republicans who are supposed to be repelled by Trump and switch sides? This was when Hillary Clinton asked, why aren't we 20, 30 points behind? The assumption was, sure, Trump would pick up the kind of voters he's attracted, but he would lose a much larger number of people who presumably believed in democracy and justice and weren't racists. And actually, not only weren't racist, but felt that racism was worse than accusations of racism.
Well, I guess part of that issue relates to the successive strategies enacted by the Republican Party since 1965.
Indeed.
Southern strategy in 1968, the Sunbelt strategy of the 1980s, which are predicated on various forms of racial formation that have eradicated the old Democratic Party alliance of the past and have ushered in a whole raft of formerly liberal Republicans into a party of hatred.
I mean, I think it's also important to mention Trump's appeal to misogyny. He's picking up significant numbers, particularly of younger black men, for whom misogyny counts for more than racism.
And it'll be interesting to see whether the black vote holds up. One of the points that Trump made in 2016, correctly, though not all that successfully, is that the Democratic Party has relied on the black vote without giving it much in return. And it's also the case that some Latinos and Latinas who are very anti-immigration without papers are trending towards the Republican Party. And of course, many of them are conservative Catholics. And so the abortion line that the Democrats are running doesn't appeal to them. Plus, some of them are small business people and they like the idea of enterprise.
I mean, I think all that's true. I find it depressing, I guess, that nonetheless, the Republican Party is far to the right of almost any European you care to name, except maybe Viktor Orban, far to the right of AFD, of Giorgia Meloni, of Law and Justice in Poland, and yet is picking up a far higher proportion of the vote than any of those far right parties. And so I really think it does reflect, well, we go back to the Southern Strategy, I really think it does reflect the fact that the US has never got over slavery.
Has never got over?
Slavery.
Slavery, sorry, yes, absolutely. It is the foundational crime of the United States and the foundational ethos. It's impossible, implausible to read the Constitution without understanding it as the creature of slavery and rivalrous attitudes to slavery between Britain and the British in the United States. So, no, I think we're in agreement on that. When I said it's about the people who feel left behind, I really mean that there is an important group that swings towards Trump that might not necessarily vote Republican in the midterms, for example, because that's his appeal. This despite the fact that, of course, his actual policies are all in favor of the ruling class in an astonishing redistribution of income upwards that even the Democrats at their worst have not been guilty of.
Yeah, quite so.
Anyway, John, I wanted to ask you about a book I haven't read because it isn't out yet. But I think it's your next book.
Yep.
And it's about the end of neoliberalism, something I keep forecasting and announcing and being wrong about.
Sure. I actually have three books coming out, amazingly enough. None of them are what you might call monographs. So After Neoliberalism is a collection of papers I've written from the beginning of neoliberalism to, and I am happy to announce the end of it. I think Trump, for example, Trump is not a neoliberal and he has vanquished and crushed the neoliberals in the Republican Party. I think I am happy to announce the end of neoliberalism and not, however, to say that the forces of good have triumphed. So I'll give my political analysis of it. And as I say, the paper has some optimistic, the book has some optimistic papers looking to the future. But the core of it, I think, is that if you go back to the 1990s, what you had was what I've called soft neoliberals, which is Blair, Clinton, Hawke and Keating and so forth, and hard neoliberals. These all come out of the not crisis of the 1970s, the hard neoliberals, Thatcher, Reagan, and Europeans, like Mark Rutte, for example, in the Netherlands. And between them, they batted back and forth somewhat on cultural war issues and between harder and softer implementations of neoliberalism. And as from the GFC onwards, the global financial crisis, but that's an Australian acronym, I think, from the global financial crisis onwards, support for that idea has shrunk, particularly out in the electorate, which were as never deeply based, but even with now within the political class. So what you have now is Trump, of course, straightforward crony capitalism combined with protectionism, Biden pushing industry policy, So now, although there's still a sort of residual core, you know, the equivalent of the foreign policy blob, who I still have no idea other than this, it's no longer a living body of ideas. There's still a sort of centrist core that supports it, but it doesn't have the political weight to support two parties in a two-party system. So what, you know, if you have someone like Macron, for example, can manage. He's still neoliberal. He has roughly one third of the support, and then he sort of does a balancing act between Le Pen on the right and the various left, the various bits of the left against him. But yeah, so I'm certainly happy to announce the end of neoliberalism, just to say hasn't proved to be entirely a good thing.
Now, before we get onto that question, can you tell us briefly about the other two books?
Oh, yes. So,
amazing.
So one of them is not super exciting. It's a lecture note book. I did this course on politics, philosophy, and economics, talking about climate change, which is my more or less constant preoccupation, but I wasn't what I was worried about this very day. And so I gave a course on this, looking at this, and also on the concept of opportunity cost, which links to my previous book, if I can plug it, Economics in Two Lessons, a great read. And the third one is a comic book on privatization, again, telling the story of the rise and fall of privatization. And so what we're seeing in Australia, I mean, the US has a different history with this stuff, but in Australia and the UK, we're seeing, which are the two of the leading proponents of privatization, we're seeing that being rolled back steadily as its failures become evident. So this is a lifetime story of a young couple who start out at the fag end of the social democratic moment, working for a government power company and a public hospital, go through privatisation. Initially, I've slightly tweaked the history here, but initially they're quite keen on the idea, seeing the benefits that are being promised to them, and they're disillusioned as the process works. And at the end, jumping forward, it's like normality is restored and the future is bright. But these are all comic books, so I can take a few liberties. But that's certainly part of the story. I think if you want to look at the end of neoliberalism, you only need to look at privatisation, because that's something you can actually count. You can see the enterprises going back into public ownership. The British Railways, for example, the Financial Times just had a story saying that the last bits of it are being renationalised now, and this was sort of, in some sense, the last great triumph of Thatcherism was privatising British Rail.
And ironically, of course, the collapse of one of the private companies taken over by the government saw that enterprise being the only efficient one in terms of almost every indicator amongst the bevy of absurd private enterprises running that laughable system. So, Prof, I wonder if I could ask you about this end of neoliberalism in this context. For many of us, the entities that were at the international level crucial players in this were the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Because of the sorts of transformations that they went through in the 1970s and that they forced onto others. But for some critics, what matters and is the compelling residue of neoliberalism is the remarkable autonomy of international financial markets. And so the problem is that international finance is essentially immune to regulation, or let's call it democratic intervention, and that those decisions about where to invest and how long to invest for are based on indices, factors that have nothing to do with things like profitability and in understood in terms of what people want to buy, what ordinary consumers want to buy as goods or services. They are about games played, as it were, within markets. And as a consequence, they are relatively immune to democratic intervention, as I said, but they also, on a whim or on a political decision, can disinvest and produce disastrous consequences for reforming progressive economies, such as, for example, the voters chose in the case of Colombia and Chile in the last few years. So I wonder if you could comment on that, the transformation of those big public financial institutions, but also the idea of this, in a sense, absolute autonomy or relative autonomy of international markets.
So first, the international institutions, and the World Bank, I think, is, yeah, I was looking at privatization. They very clearly rode back on that a long way, that they were early advocates of it. In 2002, they were saying, look, people don't like this, but we have to stay the course. It's great stuff. And now they are, as they say, nuanced. I mean, it's important to remember, I guess, the IMF is hard line. I mean, one important thing to remember is the IMF is going to places, in some sense, by definition, that have been mismanaged. And so it's often the case, I haven't looked, but they're intervening in Pakistan, demanding privatization. I wouldn't be surprised to find that some of those public enterprises, in fact, are not very well run and but it's important not to say, well, it's all privatization is always bad. If you believe in a mixed economy, as I do, then it implies we want to be going back and forward across that boundary, depending on what happens in different circumstances. So that, I think there's much, not necessarily exclusively, much more of a role, for example, for private electricity generation in a solar and wind distributed type system. I mean, certainly, obviously, rooftop generation than there was when we actually did privatise great big coal-fired power stations. So that's those institutions. The US Treasury is usually thrown in as the third leg of the Washington consensus, but I don't have any real insight into what's happening within that. Looking at financial markets, there's two bits to it. I mean, one is the actual power they have. And in the recent past, that's really only been exercised against Liz Truss. Her policies terrified the financial markets. And of course, she wasn't, because of her ideology, in a position to just laugh them off. It wasn't that they really threatened stuff. Boris Johnson, who was doing similar stuff, just said, well, screw the financial markets. Financial markets hated Brexit. He went ahead and did it. Certainly wasn't punished for it by them. So I think a large part of their story in the 90s was not merely the ability to move money about, but the ability to scare people, to say you've lost your AAA rating, your currency is depreciating, to which the first is, well, who cares? You're the same guys who gave AAA ratings to Enron. Why should we believe anything you say? And on the second, well, look, I'm sorry that your overseas holidays are going to cost more, but it's great for our exporters. That we've given up on the idea, which really came from the older era of fixed exchange rates, that an exchange rate depreciation is such a terrible thing. And so we see this with industrial policy. That is precisely, it says, look, if you're not going to invest in this, we will. Mm. We'll borrow the money. You can't, the rate of interest is while it's a bit higher than it was, but only because the central banks made it higher. And we're just going to borrow money and do what we think is a good thing. There are some traps to be avoided there as well, but what we see now is no one, when in the Australian context, we're now discussing this Australian-made idea, which has some positive and some pretty big negative elements to it. But the crucial point is only about 30% of respondents said, look, this is the kind of thing we should leave to the markets. And that kind of criticism has really generally left people cold. So, I mean, that doesn't say the problem has been solved. There's still grossly excessive profits in these sectors and some severe rare earth misallocation of capital. But the loss of faith, I think, no one thinks these guys have the keys to the kingdom and this kind of stuff. They're just a bunch of crooks who've managed to get hold of things, and there seems to be no way of getting rid of them, seems, I would say, to be the, and among a large section, why don't we, this seems like a great racket, why don't we get into it? So crypto, meme stocks, stuff like this. No one now is looking at, as they were even in the dot-com boom, they'd look at some actual stock and get enthusiastic about it, saying, these guys have this great thing, they're going to make gigantic profits and we're going to get rich. It's now, here's this chain of movie theatres and we're going to beat the shorts of their own game. Also, the kind of crazy stuff which these guys are making a living from.
One of the things that concerns me in all of this, and I hear what you're saying, well, there are two things. One is you're saying that Australia can stand up to this stuff. But what about if you're an inverted commas less developed country in the global south? Is there the same ability to stand up? And the second is, what about the fact that in the past, the power of chief executives and less major executives in big firms was tied to the performance that was at the core of the business. And now so often it's tied to market prices, to stock prices.
Well, I think, I mean, the second point is bad for capitalism. But I guess, I mean, my rough view is so much the worse for capitalism. I mean, there's a, I mean, it's certainly true that what we're seeing is a system of corporate management, you know, which is largely disconnected, firstly disconnected from the profits, but also pushing back, I think, on somebody said, also just pushing back, also largely unrelated to any meaningful sense what consumers buy. The world's biggest companies are advertising companies.
Yeah.
You know, Google, Meta, or if they're not at, or they have control, monopoly control of platforms, which is really Amazon, or monopoly intellectual property, which is Microsoft. You know, Apple is about the only one that actually has, yes, look, you can go in, yeah, I mean, as I say, it produces something you can drop on your foot, which none of these other guys do, and none of them even produce something people like very much anymore. You know, no one, yeah. You know, when you do valuations of so-called goodwill, Microsoft and Google and Facebook have gazillions of it, but of course, that just means monopoly. It doesn't mean people have a soft glow in their heart. It means people have no choice but to use their products. And you know, it was the case, I think, until relatively recently, that Google was, you know, all of them were more popular in the past than they are now. But probably only Apple and Amazon have any remaining popular legitimacy. And the others are still making tons of money. So I think, and in that context, of course, the chief executives can pay themselves what they want. And
but what about this issue, the other question I raised, which is the capacity of, you know, a Chile, a Colombia, Solomon Islands to stand up for industry policy?
I guess I have to say I don't have a good answer to what the Greeks said to the millions, the strong do what they will and the weak bear what they must. I mean, I think that was true. I mean, importantly, though, that was true in the social democratic era as well. The IMF was going around these places telling them what they had to do to adjust. So I think the main point would be a lot of places on that list 50 years ago are not now. I mean, that's really the positive thing is no one is going to tell China or Taiwan or whatever what kind of adjustment package they have to take. So that's, you know, and even, well, until relatively recently, you were seeing the same kind of things in Africa, but that hasn't, again, it's not something I'm fully on top of, but pretty clearly progress there has been very slow for the last 4 or 5 years. And the exact reason, how much it has, yeah, it's not clear whether this is related to the pandemic or to something else.
John, about your own profession as an economist, there was some sort of transformation in the 70s.
Yes.
Which begin with Nixon saying, we're all Keynesians now, and end with nobody being a Keynesian, it seemed. Mm. Some sort of transformation, radical transformation in favor of the fantasies of neoclassical economics. And then some sort of reconversion back to Keynesianism that begins maybe in 2001 and it seems pretty comprehensive after 2008. Tell me if I'm right or wrong, and tell me how you avoided these mass religious conversions. Yeah.
Well, firstly, I'll quote Keynes himself. He says, talks about the power of ideas and then says, madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some scribbler of a couple of generations back. And so an important part of this is there's actually quite a big time lag, that the successful counterattack on Keynesianism within the economics profession was really the big point was Friedman in 1968 correctly predicting that the policies were being pursued would lead to inflation. So Nixon, by the time he said we're all Keynesian now, it had actually ceased to be true. And he then tried price controls, which didn't work at all well. And then I guess by the time the real high point of this stuff within the economics profession was really in the 1980s. There was something called new classical economics was the now my brain is failing me, rational business and rational business cycles or real business cycles. So all of this seemed to completely get away from the idea that recessions could happen for any other reason than governments doing stupid things. If something that looked like a recession happened, it must reflect some kind of actual technological shock and or change in preferences. And so, Krugman, for example, one of these things is people have an increased preference for leisure. So Krugman called the Reagan recession the Great Vacation. The idea was somehow or other everybody had just decided to take time off and become unemployed. So they were the big things that were winning. The people who won Nobel Prize for this stuff, Prescott and people like this, Rational Expectations, were doing their work in the 70s and 80s. What came in then was a whole bunch of things. One is game theory, which I'm not a huge fan of, but which hugely undermines certitude. Really, game theory says, don't believe this stuff about competitive markets. Just about anything can happen once we have big players in the market. And we also saw new ideas in macro, which tended to push back towards much more Keynesian views. So the Chicago guys are still out there and still significant, but they came back with a vengeance after 2008 with austerity in Europe, particularly. But of course, austerity was a disaster. So actual experience has made a big difference there. Coming to my own experience, I mean, it was an interesting one, which says something, I guess, possibly about relevant to the current disputes about campuses, which is I was more or less an ordinary soft lefty at high school, went to a department of economics, which had been taken over by graduates of the Chicago School, and was challenged very vigorously. But I suppose being a stubborn kind of person, pushed back. I realized that some of the things I thought couldn't be defended. For example, at the time, university education had been made free, but it was still very hard to get in. So only 20% roughly of upper class kids got there. And I was convinced that, no, this is a very bad idea, which is still relevant in a stratified system like the US, that we shouldn't be making going to Harvard debt-free. If we've got money for that, we should be giving it to make community college free first before we think about Harvard and these places. But anyway, for most things, what I did was get a really good understanding of what these guys were doing so that I can, you give me a problem and I can give you their answer, and I can also refute it, at least to my own satisfaction. I mean, not to theirs, perhaps, but yeah. So I think it does say. I think that it's important to be exposed to a range of competing ideas. I guess my problem with the current US is that the ideas of the political right are so lunatic and crazy that you can't really expose somebody to them without derision.
Yes, I. When I studied neoclassical economics, the expression that kept being used by the lecturer was ceteris paribus.
Yes.
And I kept asking, yes, but things aren't equal. What about...
That's true. Right,
not just on the economic front, poverty, but yes. Religion and language and racism and misogyny. And he'd say, no, but they're not what economics is interested in. I just couldn't believe
it. Yes, I think it's sort of I think there's something to be said for it. That is, if you think of fixing a stereo, what you do is isolate one bit and see what happens if you change that bit. Then you isolate another bit and see what happens if you change that bit. And that is ceteris paribus. You don't worry about whether the amplifier was assembled in a sweatshop or whether the music you're going to play is rubbish. You just say, all I'm going to do is see what happens if I swap these wires over. So I don't want to give a complete dismissal, but I think particularly in macro, particularly in macro, what you end up with is we have this beautiful model of what happens when everything goes right. You can do one tweak or two tweaks, holding everything else constant, and you get some interesting kind of Keynesian results usually, but not very Keynesian. What you can't do is, well, look, suppose that the macroeconomy doesn't look at all like this, what do you do? And there isn't a good answer to that, but it's probably better to be in doubt than it is in doubt and say, well, very crudely, that he's kind of hitting it with this big stick, like a major public spending program seems to fairly reliably have these effects, rather than trying to carefully refine the implications of various monetary policy fiddles and things like that.
One of your books from about a decade ago, written after the global financial crisis, talks about the economics profession as a bunch of zombies, or at least as ideas that are zombies that
Here's a zombie.
cannot die.
Yes.
Right before the global financial crisis in 2007, the University of California, where I was working, saw a demand by economists that their salaries be liberated from those of ordinary faculty, and instead benchmarked, to use the awful term of the time, against what they would get if they were working for corporations or banks. I was opposed to this. Needless to say, my opinion was completely irrelevant and unimportant. However, after the global financial crisis, I put my hand up in meetings and said, doesn't this mean you should all now be fired?
Yes.
Because the way you think is now worth officially nothing. Again, sadly, my entirely reasonable intervention, which was no doubt considered a minor outburst, had no effect. But there is this sense in which these ideas that you shredded a decade ago and more don't go away. And part of that is, as you say, because there are elements to them that are analytically useful. And part of it's because at the microeconomic level, they can actually make some sense of how firms operate. So I wonder if you could reflect back on that pathbreaking book, perhaps adumbrate it for people, and say why you think the zombies are now gone.
Well, so some are and some aren't, I think it's fair to say. So, and I think I said this at the time. So one of them is trickle-down economics. And I say, look, you can find, I mentioned, I think, the hymn, All Things Bright and Beautiful. I don't know if your religious tradition had that hymn, but God made them all. Verse two, the rich man in his castle, the poor man at the gate, God made them high and lowly and ordered their estate. So roughly speaking, as long as there are rich people, there will be somebody in the prevailing dominant ideology to explain why it is good that they're rich people and why this should stay that way. And so I sort of said, this is a zombie that will never die, but we can nonetheless push back against it at various points. Then I guess I guess the one that I think has most thoroughly died is the efficient financial markets hypothesis, that financial markets are the best possible judge of everything. I mean, it's isn't completely gone in the sense of we really have no idea. In the same way as weather forecasts 3 months in advance or something like that, we know we really can't do it. But if somebody's going to put their hand up, we'll pay attention, even though the skill is very low. So we sort of still pay a bit of attention to what the financial markets do. But no one now would say, well, look, the financial markets are valuing Google at such and such, so it must be worth this. We've seen them get things spectacularly wrong. And in between, I think austerity is an idea which I should say, well, its appeal, of course, long, its intuitive appeal long is from outside economics. Yeah. Angela Merkel's Swabian housewife tightening her belt, this kind of stuff. Economists on the whole have been, especially since Keynes, been less, as a group, less appealed to austerity than financial markets or than common sense conservative politicians. If you look at talk about the budget surplus, for example, and see economists talking about people described economists talking about this stuff, you will discover that they are what we used to call bank johnnies. They're people whose primary job, of course, is to appear with the name of the bank emblazoned across the TV screen. And then Ormerod was the person who pointed that out for me. But of course, having got in front of the TV, they have to say something and they're going to pitch their bank's line.
That
And
logic.
so, and so, but they are no more economists than the guy in the white coat used to be saying 9 out of 10 doctors smoke camels or
Because they're good for your throat.
Yes. I
Yes,
can't
of
remember which
course.
one it was.
I love these metaphors. Belt tightening, of course, derives literally from the Great Depression.
Yes.
And
And so, yeah.
a small business in making additional holes in belts as people got thinner because of the poverty they were experiencing.
Yes.
So it's not as though you adjust to some economic changes in inflation, for
Yeah.
example, by trimming your consumption somewhat. It's a desperate
Yeah.
attempt to survive.
Yeah.
On this issue of austerity, that makes me think about the British situation since 2010 and Brexit,
Yes.
where we saw the bourgeois media essentially ignore what economists had to say about austerity and Brexit, because the economists had gone through this transformation or were going
Yes.
through it in many cases. And some people suggest that this was more about an ideological commitment on the part of the Tories, the Conservative Party, to shrinking the state and redistributing income upwards. Does that make sense to you, or do you think they actually
I
believe
think,
stuff?
oh no, I think if you, the Australian saying, I don't know, because only Australian is given the choice between a conspiracy and a cock up, go for the cock up. But what you had, I think, what you had, and I think the Iraq, I'll go back and say the Iraq war was like this. That is, there are all sorts of people who, for one reason or another, thought it'd be a good idea for the US to invade Iraq. There were people who thought that they could establish a beacon of democracy there. And there were people who thought they could loot the oil and get it out. And there were people who thought Israel needed a reliable ally. And you sort of, yeah, to take those last two, the obvious point is the last thing you want to do if you want a reliable ally for Israel is establish a democracy anywhere in the Middle East. Yeah, you can buy off Mohammed bin Salman. You can't buy off the average Saudi Arabian. And so, yeah, but they all went in assuming that they would get what they wanted out of it. And you add to, and I guess the general barrister's maxim, which is also true of referendums, if you don't know the answer, don't ask the question. You should never give people, you never, yeah. So you had a bunch of old people who imagined you would get, yeah, somehow or other bring Winston Churchill back. You had a bunch of people on the Tory right who thought that we would, that we would, that you could establish, a new swashbuckling free trade area. You had a bunch of other Tories who, very much the opposite. Who, yeah, they didn't like free movement of people in particular, which, of course, yeah, roughly speaking, the capitalist class generally does like. They didn't really like free trade. What they wanted to do was get all those nasty Europeans out of the place and be able to do what they wanted without interference from Brussels. So, and you know, on the day, taken collectively, those people got 52%, and then you had this kind of internal logic of spiral that. Although, to the extent there was a sensible case for Brexit, it was a kind, it was say, let's move back to the kind of situation that, say, Norway, I think, Switzerland has, we'll get out of the, we won't be fully in the market, but we will, we'll essentially maintain things, whatever the price is for stopping free movement, we'll pay that price. And we won't be put, we'll be, well, still possibly even contributing to the budget. So they were the sensible people, but once all the Remainers had been driven, had their, were out of the discussion, it was within the Tory party. And so what you got was Theresa May saying Brexit means Brexit and Boris Johnson doing whatever. And so you end up with this totally crazy situation. And then, of course, you have Keir Starmer essentially saying, look, I'm, you know, Any, yeah, well, roughly speaking, I'm going to screw my own voters. What I need are these allegedly left behind people in whom, as I've previously said, I don't really believe.
And just to give some context there, so John mentioned a barrister, which means a trial attorney in the United States.
That's correct. Sorry,
And
yes.
Keir Starmer is the leader of His Majesty's loyal opposition, the Labour Party.
Opposition, indeed.
But
Yes.
he is basically to the right of Blair in lots of ways in terms of what he
In many
said.
respects,
Whether
yes.
he will act in that way is another matter. But one of
Well, it's
the
already fit
push,
once.
yeah,
Because he
and
ran against the previous leader, Jeremy Corbyn, only marginally. Jeremy Corbyn's well on the left. Skarmer ran only marginally to Corbyn's right, and then has reversed himself very substantially. And it's not, I haven't, but I have no insight into his thing. If I could just give one illustration pointing against the Left Behind story, it's that the big success of Brexit was replacing EU Burgundy passports with traditional British blue passports, which happen to be made in France. But the crucial point is, if you're this Left Behind person in some northern pit village, you presumably don't have a passport and don't care about the colour of it. This was, yeah, the people who were left behind are overwhelmingly well off. Yeah, the core group is well off elderly people who remember the days when they could look down on Europe and who didn't, yeah, and when a British passport was the best passport to have. And so again, I sort of just I don't buy any of this Left Behind story to any significant extent at all.
I guess one argument for it would be to say that during the Blair Brown hegemony in favor of globalization, structural adjustment was not taken with sufficient seriousness in terms of providing opportunities for people who'd been in the extractive and manufacturing sectors to learn new possibilities, to retrain, to get access to higher education. And that it took a long time because of their sense of loyalty to the Labour Party. But these folks, especially in Northern England, turned to the Tories in 2019, in part as an eventual effect of being ignored, and in part because of a successful campaign against Corbyn, based on red baiting.
Well, I mean, I suppose what I'd say is, I'm sure many of them explain themselves that way. But as I mentioned, Blair and Brown were the soft version of neoliberalism. It was Thatcher who destroyed all these industries. So, I'm sure people tell themselves this story, but I don't buy that. I don't buy there was anyone out there who literally believes in a meaningful way that that Trump or Johnson is going to do much for their jobs. I mean, no, I should say there must be some because people are very vulnerable, but there's certainly no rational basis for that belief. And so the only way you would acquire it is if it's motivated essentially by cultural animus of some kind.
And Prof, I wonder if we could finish the conversation by moving on to climate change,
Yes.
the climate crisis, the environmental disaster.
Yeah.
One of the things that you were saying your wife is very concerned with, and also something that you're concerned about. Could you talk to us about that and what needs to be done? Because we get lots
Yeah.
of pricing options in which the genius of the market, the invisible hand will come and save us all. And we get de-development arguments that say cease industrialization. We get arguments that want to hold the former imperial and current imperial powers responsible. We get arguments that say per capita, Australia and Norway should all be in, if the population should be in jail because of how they benefit from this horror. We get arguments that say, if you want to keep rabbiting on about the global north, you really need to think about India and China.
Sure. Well, I think we have read, we've been, in my view, we've been essentially been through all those arguments, and in some sense, come to a standstill on the policy front. But I think one way or another, we have had the fortune that the policy we've had have done such a great job in promoting the development of solar PV that we're now actually, I'm now actually, I don't think, I don't, I think Lomborg was 100% wrong. 15 years ago, we had to do all this stuff, but we now have the situation where it's really going to be technology doing the heavy lifting. That the case for first for carbon free. I don't like renewable as a term, but carbon free electricity is overwhelming. We're really now, when you look at the situation, we're really now stuck with gluts on complicated things like transmission. And in the US, it's incredibly expensive. If you have a solar panel that costs 20 cents a watt coming out of China, and it costs you $3 to put it on your roof in the US, whereas Australia, Australia is covered in the things, of course. And so I'm actually relatively optimistic, certainly of avoiding the worst disasters in climate change. I mean, we're seeing big disasters. I think it's likely we'll lose most of the world's coral reefs, for example, which is pretty awful. But compared to the kind of 4, 5, 6 degree scenarios, which seemed entirely plausible, and I think would have happened if all of our tech options had failed, if wind hadn't worked, solar hadn't worked, efficiency improvements hadn't been available, we'd be heading for 4 or 5 or 6 degrees and just wringing our hands saying, well, what can we do? As we're doing, as I've mentioned, with the pandemic. In the end, I think we'll see this so-called bird flu become cease to be a bird flu very soon. And we've all, rather than having learned the lessons from COVID, we've learned that we're helpless and we'll fail.
In terms of how that technology gets developed, distributed, and used, it's clear that there are various market forces that are doing this because they can see that it's necessary and see that it's providential. What's the role of the state versus capital in this proliferation of and development and proliferation of these new technologies?
Well, it's right at the center of the industry policy debate because China has been, of course, both the biggest contributor to, it's now, even historically, all those arguments about history are now really obsolete when you talk about China. I mean, and they're kind of obsolete when it comes to Africa, because the original version of it was coal is cheap but dirty, solar is expensive, clean but expensive. We need to have a chance to go for coal, have our turn on coal. But now that for anywhere that doesn't already have it, it's a crazy idea. Africa will never go for coal, just as it will never have a really well developed fixed line telephone network. It's they've leapfrogged that particular bit of technology. So that's the side issue. So, but because China has been so dominant, because China doesn't play by any kind of market rules, we're seeing this big rush across the world to put money into this, partly by taxing China, taxing Chinese exports into rich country markets, which we're seeing more of them going to Africa, but largely by increasing even more the total supply, which is already, although it's not more than the end market can consume, but it's already overwhelming the processes that are supposed to manage this. And we just have to see how fast that stuff will change, how long we're going to put up with incredibly complicated processes for putting up transmission lines and so forth. As they all, people will just buy them and hang them over their fences, as I saw a recent photo, not worry about any of these permits. So I think we are, we have seen market forces, but it was government subsidies, particularly in Germany, which really kick-started the whole solar and wind stuff. They sort of dropped the ball 10 or 15 years ago, but by then, the process was well underway. The Europeans, of course, had the carbon price, which is a successful kind of neoliberal policy, I guess, at the soft end. And it's interesting, of course, that the hard neoliberals hated this idea, had to resort to climate denial to say, we believe markets can solve it, but we can't have Pigouvian taxes because that would be bad. So we have to believe, we have to simply deny the science in order to preserve our position.
And Prof, I've got one more question for you, if I may, after which I'd like to throw it back to you to add anything you may wish to what we've said or subtract, should there be things you wish you'd not said or wish that I'd not said. So my last question before handing over to you is about socialism and socialism and democracy. These are things that many of us hold dear but are almost unsayable in many contexts. You've said today that you're in favor of mixed markets, mixed economies. What's your take on socialism?
Well, I guess the kind, yeah, I mean, it, both socialism and capitalism are terms which are very elastic. But yeah, I suppose my idea, which I've set out, an idea of 2050, will be one with very few large private companies, a big role for small businesses of various kinds, and also, which I haven't had time to get to, but which I think we're seeing the beginnings of, radically changed working arrangements, a return to the kind of trends we were seeing until the 1970s of increased worker empowerment, shorter hours, more control over people's lives. So yeah, that's my version of socialism. One of the things I did learn from my economics education, although I fought hard on this, is that that comprehensive central planning is a dumb idea. And I suppose 40 years in the university sector dealing with strategic plans has only confirmed me very strongly in that view. So we can certainly say we're going to help this sector and not that sector, but the idea that we can predict in 5 years' time where the economy is going to be with any precision, or that we should, I think is a mistake. So I suppose, yeah, I would see a world without any billionaires and without any big corporations, but certainly with very few big corporations, but with plenty of room for people who want to start a restaurant or a car repair shop or something like this to do so.
And sorry if I can, I said that was my last question. I want to pick up on what you said to ask something else. What would that mean in terms of supply lines, in terms of...
That's a good question. I mean, I think we probably have gone from excessive faith in these things to a big reaction against it. But the other thing I suppose is that for most of us, this won't be an issue. It's not an issue. Yeah, we're talking, you're in Madrid, I'm in outback Queensland. There is a supply line, I guess. Yeah, there's almost certainly a physical cable running between us somewhere. But I think part of the transition will be that the goods economy will become a smaller and smaller part of people's lives. There'll be robots building other robots to build most of the things we need, and lots of what's done will be, more of it will be information services, and even the stuff that isn't, I think, cafes and so forth will change their nature in ways I can't fully elaborate, that away from a model where notions like supply lines are really a big deal.
So you're returning to Keynes's notes to grandchildren, whereby 1963, I think, we'll all have 15 to 30-hour weeks thanks to compound interest and technology.
Mm. I in fact, did a complete analysis of that, pointing out, as happens, Keynes was a bachelor. No, he wasn't a bachelor, but he was a childless man, and he was applying his calculation to other childless men. He hadn't, I mean, although he mentions a charwoman briefly, he hasn't worked out in this story how compound interest is going to eliminate the work of the charwoman. And of course, he hasn't remotely considered, I mean, he was a great kind of person in many ways, but very much a British person who didn't ever think about what was happening in India to support his lifestyle. So I did his sums and said, no, we are now approaching the point when we could do it, because we actually needed to apply that not to well-off white men, but to everybody. And that requires quite another few generations, which we're now seeing. I would say now we have the capacity, we clearly have the capacity to eliminate world poverty anytime we choose to do so. And we have the capacity to do it while working steadily less hours.
Prof, I wonder if there are things to conclude that you'd like to add to what we've discussed.
Well, I guess I'd just like to mention, I guess, because it is culture, that that all of this, I suppose I've been making this point, pushing back against left behind sort of stories, all of this stuff is complicated by the culture wars, which I see this as where people are left behind. That is, there are people who grew up believing the kind of things that people believed about gay people when I was young, who still believe that have been shamed into not saying it, and who see themselves as the true representatives of the people, and this kind of thing, I think. As I say, it's not a huge deal in Australia. I mean, I think our referendum was in the cock-up rather than conspiracy class. Just the people who ran it made a god awful mess of a process that ought to have worked. This is on recognizing the indigenous people of the country formally in a formal kind of structure. Just the people in charge screwed that up. But most of the time, these issues don't seem, you know, these issues have largely disappeared in Australia. So it's difficult to, there's no real high temperature stuff about it. So it's difficult to understand even, you know, the UK and US, possibly because they were great imperial powers, seem to have much more attraction to that. I think there's a famous saying, Australia calls itself the lucky country, but the subtitle from 60 years ago is a second rate country run by second rate people who share its luck. So the lucky country is not blessed by God. It's just, it's much more, we drew the winning ticket in the lottery here. You know, best place to be in the world, but not really due to our merit, except on the sporting field and maybe on the battlefield. But so there never been a country which has really seen itself as a beacon for the world in any particular way, I guess.
Well, without being a beacon, nevertheless, it's got some good ideas coming from it, and many of them from you. So thank you so much for being so generous with your time and thoughts today. It's been great having the chance to chat with you.
Thanks very much. Okay, I'll look forward to listening to what I said.